You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the two candidates for state Supreme Court justice met in their first debate last Friday. We'll recap what they had to say and where the race stands 2 weeks before Election Day. First, the city of brotherly love isn't showing much affection to retailers who want to go cash-free. Starting in July, Philadelphia will become the first major U.S. city to ban cashless stores. Businesses that want to do away with cash say it's more efficient for workers who don't have to count paper money and coins. They also say it's safer because employees don't have to carry large bank deposits. But what about people who don't have credit or debit cards or prefer paying with cash because of privacy concerns? You can let us know where you come down at 800-642-1234. Should retailers be allowed to ban purchases made with cash, or should they have to take cash? If you're a business owner, does cash have a place in your store, or is it more trouble than it's worth? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Calvert is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He focuses on urban decay and other challenges facing older cities. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, talk about this rise of cashless stores. How common is this?
Well, it's pretty uncommon still. I think, you know, most places you walk into a store, they will gladly take your cash. So it's very much in the minority. And in Philadelphia, big city, obviously, there are just a handful of places that the city's aware of that currently don't take cash. They tend to be eateries, you know, food establishments of one sort or another. There's a salad chain called Sweetgreen that has gone cashless. There was at least one clothing store in Philadelphia that is on the city's list of places that don't take cash. So it's definitely a very small number, but seems to be growing.
Right. There's an idea that, okay, it may not be in a lot of places now, but it could be the wave of the future. And then a city like Philadelphia is saying, so we better get on top of this.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, that's sort of an argument both for and against this kind of legislation. From the proponent standpoint, now is a great time to sort of tap the brakes because it won't be that disruptive. There aren't that many businesses that will have to start taking cash again, or if they never have, start taking cash. On the other hand, you know, another way to look at it is that we are sort of moving, perhaps slowly but inexorably, toward this cashless society, and Philadelphia is trying to sort of hold that back in a way that might ultimately prove to be futile.
So, what does this rule in Philadelphia look like now? What do they say, and who do they exempt from it?
Right. So as you say, it's starting in July, and it applies to all retail establishments, you know, with some exceptions. So, you know, first of all, any business that does business by telephone, mail, internet, those kind of transactions, those aren't covered. Parking lots and garages are exempt. Wholesale clubs like BJ's, Costco, they're also exempt. You know, you can rent a car. They can still require, you know, they can still refuse to accept cash. Things like that, but otherwise it's you know, you have to take cash starting in July.
What's been the argument for people against cashless stores? Put it another way, what's the argument against regulating those cashless stores?
Well, I think the argument would be, you know, let the market kind of sort it out. And the National Retail Federation sort of makes this point that, you know, the government shouldn't put its thumbs on the scales here. And you know, if a store wants to go cashless and they find that people they start losing business as a result of that, then odds are they'll go back to taking cash. But if it works out for them, then they should be allowed to, you know, to do that. It should be okay for them and their customers to have that kind of arrangement. So that's basically the argument.
And why are people saying we shouldn't have cashless stores?
Well, that's because, as you said at the top, you know, the reality is, I mean, a lot of people do have a credit card or debit card or some kind of, you know, smartphone payment app. But there are lots of folks who don't. And if you look at the statistics nationwide, there are around 8 million U.S. households that are considered unbanked, which the FDIC defines as not having a checking or savings account. And Philadelphia has a 26% poverty rate. So about a quarter of the population lives below the poverty line. And, you know, many of those folks may not have a debit card or credit card. And So the sponsor of the legislation basically said, look, you know, it's not fair for those people to not be able to use the cash in their pocket to buy something, and that it's essentially discriminatory, even if that's not the intention.
Talking to Scott Calvert from the Wall Street Journal about cashless stores and a regulation in a major city now, Philadelphia, in this case, putting the kibosh on cashless retail in many cases, with some exceptions. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Exonia. Daryl, hi. That sounds like we lost Daryl. Maybe the guest. Are you still there, Scott?
I'm here.
Okay, yeah, that sounded like a guest dropping noise. Well, we didn't, though. He was worried, Daryl, that this could affect older people who might be more prone to not have credit cards, who might not be internet savvy for certain kinds of shopping. Is that something that's been raised as a concern?
Yeah, I think there's a concern that you know, elderly folks, I mean, on some level, it's force of habit. It's just what they're used to, and they feel more comfortable paying with cash. And again, you know, the argument is they shouldn't be forced to not be able to use the cash. And it's interesting too, because I got a lot of email from people saying, wait a minute, you know, how can any business not accept cash to begin with? Because if you look at your dollar bill or whatever, it'll say that, you know, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. But as it happens, you know, there is no federal law that says a business has to accept cash.
Now, I'm seeing around the country more examples. Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta says it's going to become the first NFL stadium to go cashless. I understand that they're going to have machines where you could put cash in, get a credit card or a temporary card that doesn't have a fee on it. So some people are coming out with workarounds to try to, you know, take the cash without directly taking the cash.
That's right. Yeah, it's a reverse ATM machine, and I think there are 10 of them around the stadium. And so, you know, if you've only brought cash that day, or if you just don't want to use your debit card to buy your hamburger or whatever, you can put cash into the machine, and like you say, it'll spit out a debit card that doesn't have a transaction fee, so you're not paying for that, and then you can use it. And you know, as you say, that's the first NFL stadium, and so there may be others. And just on that note, I mean, you know, anybody can get a debit card, but there are typically fees associated with that. So that's why people say, you know, it's not simply good enough to just say, well, go get yourself a debit card and then you can shop wherever you want.
Now we've got this in Philadelphia. What are retailers, those few retailers who already went cashless, saying about this? If they're going to have to change?
Well, I talked to the owner, co-owner of a falafel place at the University of Pennsylvania Food Court, and he isn't happy about it. You know, he thinks it's not great policy. I mean, he's going to comply because it's the law of the city, and he's not going to challenge it or anything like that. But you know, he doesn't think it is good policy to mandate this sort of thing. But, you know, it's sort of beyond his control at this point.
We heard from Chris in Fitchburg, who called to say she had a friend who had to use cash for everything after going through bankruptcy, and it was difficult. And I guess, yeah, going through bankruptcy makes it harder, maybe impossible to get that credit card in the first place. Is this something that people are bringing up?
That's a good point. I haven't heard that specific issue raised. But, you know, it is worth pointing out that even though there's been this slow move away from cash, about 30% of all transactions in the country involve cash. And that number is much higher, percentage is much higher for, you know, smaller purchases like under $10, that sort of thing. But I tell you, it's interesting to see what happens, because just today, the governor of New Jersey signed a very similar bill into law in New Jersey that, like the Philadelphia law, will in most cases ban cashless stores. There is a bill working its way through the New York City Council that would do something similar. Massachusetts has had a law on its books now for a few decades. So this could be the start of a trend.
Right. And are you watching for now more states and cities to join, as you say, Philadelphia, New Jersey, Massachusetts, New York City? Is this going to be something that states and cities are going to be grappling with in the years to come?
I think it's fair to say. I think that people are other cities and states are probably going to be watching very closely to see how things go in New Jersey and Philadelphia, and perhaps follow suit. But even in Philadelphia, it's worth pointing out that the city officials say, look, you know, we think that it makes sense to kind of press pause, but they know big picture, long term, this is not something that they want to be a permanent law. They hope it's going to be sort of a temporary thing. And there was a top city official told the city council not long ago, said, look, modernization is going to happen with or without Philadelphia, and we want to be part of it. The trick is finding a way so that those folks that, you know, are at the lower end of the income spectrum aren't shut out in the process.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Calvert is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. We talked with him about Philadelphia becoming the first U.S. city to ban cashless stores. Coming up, we get the highlights from Friday's debate for Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a ruling from the Connecticut Supreme Court last week could shake up the gun industry's usual protections against lawsuits that try to hold gun makers liable in crimes such as the Sandy Hook massacre. We'll find out what's at stake. First, the two candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court justice met for the first time this past Friday. Judges Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn debated at the State Bar Center in Madison. Neubauer said her history on the bench speaks for itself.
My record shows that I am tough but fair. My record shows that I am fair, impartial, and independent as a judge.
Hagedorn said he has no trouble putting aside his personal feelings while on the bench.
You know, I believe my job as a judge is to say what the law is and not what I think the law should be. My job is to uphold the Constitution as written, which I'm committed to, and also protecting the public.
The winner of the April 2nd election will fill the seat being vacated by longtime Justice Shirley Abrahamson. She announced last summer that she has cancer and will not seek another 10-year term. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Big picture, Sean, did we learn anything new about our candidates in this debate?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think what you saw was the two candidates right up next to each other on a stage saying some of the same things to each other that you've been seeing the campaigns do kind of at a distance for a while now. So the themes going into this were very much present at this debate on Friday night.
And we think of judges maybe in the abstract as, you know, having this sense of decorum, right? Calmness that we wouldn't see from candidates in other races. This got a little tense from time to time.
They were very polite, but it is a very intense race if you kind of break down what they're saying about each other. And that is, they're both saying that in this nonpartisan race, you cannot trust the other person because they are way too political and they would politicize the court.
Right. Each candidate saying, I am the balanced and fair candidate. The other one is the extreme political candidate.
Yeah, very much. So Judge Lisa Neubauer never veered from kind of her opening statement to the closing statement from some talking points that she was going to be tough, independent, and fair on the bench. She mentioned repeatedly how many endorsements she has. She said 345 endorsements from judges around the state. That is a major point for her. She's saying that they know the kind of work that we do, and they're all coming to my campaign and not Judge Hagedorn's campaign. Judge Hagedorn's talking point throughout this is kind of what you would hear from other conservatives who've run for the court over the past, you know, 12 years or so. And that is, I will adhere to the Constitution. I will adhere to, you know, the text as it is written or its earliest interpretation and pretty much nothing more. So that's something we've gotten used to over the past decade or so. That sort of tough but fair kind of law and order approach from Neubauer, though, is maybe something you didn't hear as strongly from the liberal candidates a few years back.
And a difficult thing, I think, for voters and the media in races like these for a court is, we want to get some kind of indication on how a candidate would rule on particular high-profile issues, and that's one thing that, as judges, they say they can't do.
Yeah, even when it comes to, say, Roe versus Wade and abortion rights, always a hot-button issue in a campaign like this. Did they view the Roe versus Wade decision as the law of the land, they were asked in so many words? And they both basically said yes. I mean, Judge Neubauer said yes. And Judge Hagedorn said that is, you know, that's what I would abide by. So if you're looking for a hint there, they didn't really give any. They were also asked about justices that they admire. And this is another way for voters to get some kind of a hint about where they're coming from, because you know, if you know these Supreme Court justices, U.S. Supreme Court justices, and their leanings, sometimes you can gather where these judicial candidates are coming from. Hagedorn said Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, who are currently on the court, and former Justice Antonin Scalia were among those that he admired. Judge Neubauer declined to name anyone. She said, "Judge me by my record on the bench. I have a long record. Look at that, not, you know, what justice I admire on the court."
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about this weekend's debate between the two candidates for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court seat, that election coming up on April 2nd. So let's look at how they kind of went after each other. How did Judge Hagedorn, first of all, make the case that Judge Neubauer would be a liberal voice on the state Supreme Court?
He is talking about who's supporting her. I mean, one of the things that I've heard last week that Eric Holder was in town, former U.S. Attorney General under President Obama. He's supporting Judge Neubauer in this race and, you know, said that if progressives and liberals turn out, they will win in races like these, lower turnout races like these. So, you know, that's something that Hagedorn and Republicans have tried to highlight is look at who's supporting her, that she has groups like the Greater Wisconsin Committee or, you know, a group affiliated with Greater Wisconsin running ads on her behalf. That's a liberal group. And he's saying, look at who her supporters are. And if you want to get a good idea of where she's coming from.
And in response, I imagine she went back to what you were saying she was saying all along.
Well, she did. She said, look at my record. I'm tough, fair, independent. But she also said, look at Hagedorn's look at Judge Hagedorn's experience here. The bulk of his professional career was spent as chief legal counsel for Governor Scott Walker, which is true. He was Governor Scott Walker's chief legal counsel as soon as he became governor. So one of the governor's first appointments, which means he is the top lawyer in the governor's office. He served there for several years before Governor Walker named him to the appellate bench. And he later won election to that seat. But that was Judge Neubauer's response, is to say, look at Judge Hagedorn's experience here. She also wanted to talk a bit about stuff he's written in blogs and a school he helped found, a Christian school he helped found. Again, these are all things that have kind of played out in the media between the campaigns. Here they were, though, on Friday night between the candidates.
So talk about those blog posts and that school. Why did these become issues?
Well, the blog posts were very, I guess, forthcoming from Hagedorn. These were back in 2005 when he was talking about his views on the law and kind of intersected with public policy and talking about a U.S. Supreme Court decision that struck down a Texas anti-sodomy law as potentially opening the door to bestiality was one of them. She also talked about this Christian school that he helped found, an elementary school where there is an employment policy or where there's a code of conduct that bars students, parents, and teachers from participating in immoral sexual activity. And the school defines immoral sexual activity as any form of touching or nudity for the purposes of evoking sexual arousal, apart from the context of marriage between one man and one woman. That is something that she's saying, look what he's doing right now and how is he going to be fair on the court? Judge Hagedorn's response to that is, I have always kept that separate from my job on the bench. And by you criticizing me for my association with this school, it shows that you couldn't be fair.
And that's a big argument here. How much can we look at a judicial candidate's past personal political statements and try to glean how they would rule as a justice? This has come up in past races, I think.
It has. I mean, one that comes to mind is sitting Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote some letters to the editor when she was in college. Those were publicized in her race. She talked about them, said she regretted some of the things that she had said back then and kind of moved on and won. In Hagedorn's case, he wrote quite a bit in 2005 in these blogs. So you have more of a window to where he was coming from on some of these things than you would your average candidate. With Judge Neubauer, those writings aren't out there, but she was appointed by a Democratic governor. Her daughter is a Democratic state legislator. Her husband was a Democratic state legislator. So her Democratic ties are pretty out there for everyone to see, too, just in different ways.
Talk about turnout in this kind of race, Sean. There's not another big hot race in Wisconsin the same day as this court race.
No, there's not. And so it becomes a case of who can get, their people out to the polls. And traditionally, I think you'd say, at least over the last decade or so, that Republicans have been very good at this. They know how to send a message in these officially nonpartisan races that, hey, so-and-so is our candidate. Get out there, especially Southeast Wisconsin, get out there and vote for this person. In 2018, it was liberals who got their voters to the polls. And it was Justice Rebecca Dallet who won with a kind of a wave of liberal support in 2018 in a relatively low turnout race. She won all over the state, had a very good showing. And so I think if you're going to see another typically low turnout type race, as I think we probably are, just given the lack of other races on the ballot, it's going to be a question of who can turn out their people again this year.
And the big overarching thing here is, and we've talked about this before, assuming that we can fairly call candidates liberal or conservative on the state Supreme Court, there's arguments, but right now we have this 4-3 conservative majority, a liberal leaving. If the liberal candidate, I'm putting that in quotes, wins this time, that sets up a really big race next year.
Yes, it does. So if Judge Neubauer wins this time, she preserves that 4-3 split on the court. Conservatives would still have a 4-3 majority on the court. But next year would be Justice Dan Kelly up for his first election. He was appointed by Governor Scott Walker. And Kelly is part of that 4-3 conservative majority. So his race would absolutely determine the ideological balance of the court. And I think you would see gobs of money, national money, coming into this race if that indeed happens in 2020. But we still have this 2019 race to contend with Neubauer and Hagedorn.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked to him about last Friday's debate between Judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer. They're both candidates for Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. There are two more forums scheduled before Election Day on April 2nd, and the winner gets a 10-year term on the State Supreme Court. Coming up, last week, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that the Sandy Hook lawsuit filed against gun makers by family members of victims will be allowed to move forward on one particular claim. We'll learn why this could be a big moment in gun politics and the legal system. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent and her guests look at a new plan aimed at reducing child poverty around the nation and here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Connecticut Supreme Court made a ruling last week that could have a big impact on gun makers and sellers. The ruling would allow family members of the 9 victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre to go forward with a lawsuit against Remington, the maker of the rifle that was used by the attacker. If the lawsuit ultimately goes to the U.S. Supreme Court level, it could mean potentially a change for the gun industry, but how likely is that to happen, and can gun manufacturers be held liable? Harry Wilson is a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in Virginia. He's also the author of several books on the topic of gun control and public opinion. His latest is called Gun Politics in America, Historical and Modern Documents in Context. Harry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Happy to be with you.
Well, before we get into the particulars of this case, Harry, let's talk about this federal law that's really a big part of the story here, the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act that goes back to 2005. What did that act establish?
Well, what that act really established is that it essentially gave pretty significant immunity to firearms manufacturers. Now, critics say it gave them blanket immunity, and it really did not do that. But it gave them significant immunity in the sense that there were a lot of lawsuits going on at that time trying to hold gun manufacturers responsible for various criminal acts that had been committed by other people, essentially by third parties. And the argument in opposition to this, and very few of those cases went very far. Most of them were eventually tossed out of court, And in very, very few of those cases did the plaintiff prevail. So the gun manufacturers won in virtually all those places, but it did cost them significant amounts of money to defend themselves. And the argument there was what was really happening here was that these were essentially, from the perspective of gun manufacturers, these were nuisance lawsuits. And they were designed not actually to win. They were simply designed to bankrupt gun manufacturers and or force them to pass additional costs along to buyers, making firearms prohibitively expensive. And some very small manufacturers did go out of business. There's debate about whether or not it was because of these lawsuits. But basically, Congress became involved in this for that reason, because the gun lobby at that point in time was pretty powerful. Congress became involved and did pass this law that gave them significant, I'll call it significant, immunity in from federal and state lawsuits.
And the principle involved here from supporters, the people who passed this legislation, was if the gun manufacturer makes their products legally and sells them legally, they would not be accountable for an individual who used their products illegally. Am I summing it up fairly there?
That's an accurate summary. It was designed primarily to prevent gun manufacturers from being sued because of the actions of third parties. If they produce a defective product, they can still be sued. If they knowingly break a federal or a state law in the sale of a firearm, they may still be sued. But they can't be sued because of the actions strictly of a third-party person, unless they essentially knew that the third party would commit a criminal act with the firearm.
So, for example, if I, at some point in the gun distribution market, knowingly sell a firearm to, say, a felon who, by law, is not allowed to buy that firearm, I could potentially be held liable if they use that in the commission of a crime.
Correct. You could be, yes.
We are talking about a lawsuit in Connecticut. It's in the Connecticut State Courts for now. Harry Wilson is with us from Roanoke College in Virginia. Harry, let's take it to that lawsuit now. The Connecticut Supreme Court said this could go forward, but this is a pretty particular law. This is under a marketing law in Connecticut. Do I have that right?
To the best of my knowledge, yes. And I should make a caveat with all of your listeners that I am not an attorney.
Okay. But they're
but
not.
Yes.
This isn't just straight up your gun was used in the commission of this horrific crime at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. They targeted in this part of the lawsuit that is allowed to go forward the way that these firearms were marketed by Remington, the AR-15 Bushmaster, I believe, is the one saying that it promoted violence. It encouraged people to use their product in a violent way. This potentially, Harry, they're arguing, and the Connecticut Supreme Court says agrees enough to let the lawsuit go forward. They're saying it's violating this particular state law. Thus, it's not covered under this federal law we've been talking about. What do you make of that?
I think this is a stretch for them. And they did throw out, in fairness, they threw out several other parts
right.
of this lawsuit. So there's only one part of this lawsuit that can go forward, and you're right, that it's regarding how these firearms were marketed. And there again, in the 2005 congressional act that we just talked about, one of the stipulations in that, excluded from that, is you would have to establish that the manufacturer or seller of the firearm knowingly violated a state or federal statute applicable to the sale or marketing of the firearm, and the violation was a proximate cause of the harm for which relief is sought. That's a high legal bar to reach, that they had to be aware that they were knowingly violating a state or federal statute, and that marketing was a proximate cause of the harm. Those are two very, I think, difficult standards to meet, right? What the Connecticut Supreme Court said was they're allowing this case to go forward and see if that standard can be met. I think it's very questionable whether those standards can be met.
And that would be up to the state courts in this instance. But first, This is going to be appealed, it looks like, directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, as I understand it, saying, okay, does this violate this Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, this federal law? So do you expect, or the next question, I guess, and there's no predicting this, the next question is whether the U.S. Supreme Court will even choose to review this, right?
That's a question, although my guess on that would be yes, that I think probably they could find the four conservative members of the Supreme Court who would be willing to hear this case. I could be wrong about that, and it might be how they think, presumably Chief Justice Roberts would vote on that. But if they think he would vote with them, they would be most likely willing to take the case. And I think that's the hope certainly right now of Remington and other gun manufacturers, because this would open the door to potentially to lots of other lawsuits. So certainly the Remington wants to appeal this to the Supreme Court and hopes that the Supreme Court would take the case and not allow the Connecticut case to go forward, saying that it's prohibited under the 2005 PLCAA.
Now, this is a big if, whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court takes this up. If the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't take it up and allows this case to move forward in Connecticut, is this a big change? Is this a game changer in terms of potential lawsuits, not just under this Connecticut law, but under other state laws?
My understanding is that several other states, many other states, have similar laws, so that similar suits could, in fact, be brought against gun manufacturers in other states. And even again, if none of those prevail, we could be back where we were almost 20 years ago, where this still becomes a significant cost for gun manufacturers, and Remington's already in bankruptcy court, so that it could become a significant cost for them. So it's a tactic that was used back then by gun control supporters, again, trying to make it simply more difficult. Hopefully, from their perspective, they would hope to win. But even if they would lose, they could force other people to spend money. The other thing that they can do here is potentially, through discovery, get at some of the marketing strategies by various gun companies. And if they could uncover something in there that indicated emails back and forth between people about, yeah, we're really trying to market this to a specific type of person, or we're trying to market it in this way, that could be very damaging to gun manufacturers. So this is potentially, I would say, very damaging to them.
We're talking with Harry Wilson, professor of political science at Roanoke College in Virginia. We're talking about legal liability for gun manufacturers and a lawsuit in Connecticut courts by parents of children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your comments. Do you think gun makers should be held liable if they produce the weapon used in a crime, a mass shooting in this instance? How about the gun seller? Do you have a different idea for liability behind filing a lawsuit? And what do you think of the particular case, how guns are marketed to individuals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Harry Wilson, professor of political science at Roanoke College in Virginia. We're talking about a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer Remington. It was filed by Sandy Hook parents. The Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that one part of the suit could proceed. The U.S. Supreme Court may weigh in. If it doesn't, this would proceed then in Connecticut courts. Not clear exactly what would come out of that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think gun manufacturers, sellers, distributors should be held liable if they produce or sell a weapon used in a crime? What do you think of this particular lawsuit? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question and comment is that I think any manufacturer of any product has a responsibility to produce a safe product that can't be misused to harm others. And I look at the manufacturer of cars recently that have an automatic stop button such that police can actually prevent a car from running electronically if it's being used either in a speed to get away or to harm others. I look at that also for the guns. Aren't there ways of manufacturing a gun or not producing guns that really don't have any positive value, and that the only thing that can be done is that they can be used to harm others? Don't we have laws that require people, if they're going to produce a product, to produce something reasonably, safely, no matter what?
Charlie, thanks for the call. A lot of people have made the car and gun comparison. Harry, can you talk about that view of the manufacturers?
I can talk about that a little bit, sure. And first of all, I would suggest that if used the way they're supposed to be used, in the vast majority of cases, both vehicles and firearms are safe products if they're used the way they're supposed to be used. And when they're not, manufacturers, both of automobiles and firearms, can be held liable for that. If someone produces a vehicle that's inherently unsafe, and when it's used the way it's supposed to be used, they can be sued for that. Firearms, by definition, are, in that regard, someone might say are unsafe. I wouldn't say they're unsafe, but they're designed to do what they do, which is fire a projectile. So that clearly is a dangerous situation, in the same way, you know, 3,000 pounds moving down the road at 70 miles per hour is also inherently dangerous. So I think that's an important key to remember here. I would also sort of respond to the caller that there are many, many people and many firearms owners who would argue that these firearms, the particular gun used in Sandy Hook shooting, is used, and in fact it is used, by millions of people very safely. There's no question that they can be used, and they are used in mass shootings. I would not dispute that for a second, but they can be and are used by the vast majority, the vast, vast majority of owners, in a safe fashion. And they do have uses beyond simply killing people, the same as any other firearm has uses beyond simply killing people. No question they can be used to kill other human beings. That's just sort of a given.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Bob with us in Milwaukee. Bob, hello.
Yes.
What do you think, Bob?
I don't know where he was going with that. Growing up, I was taught to take ownership for my own actions, you know. I don't find it you could kill someone with anything. You kill someone with a knife. Are you going to go after a knife manufacturer because someone stabbed someone with a knife? You know, not to be insensitive to what happened, but...
Gotcha, Bob. Thanks for the call. So the people who do the crime, I guess Bob is saying, are the ones who should be liable, not the people who make whatever the implement is that was used in that case.
Sure, and that's a very common response from many people as well. One other corollary that I would bring up is there was a movement, this may be 20, 30 years ago also, in terms of when we were dealing with drunk driving as a major problem. Drunk driving still is a major problem. But there was a period of time when many states were talking about holding drinking establishments responsible. If they served a person X amount of liquor and that person went out and then drove a vehicle and was involved in some sort of vehicular homicide or something like that, holding that person responsible. I remember this personally because working through graduate school, I was a bartender, and there was a lot of concern on our part about, can we be held liable for this? That now seems to have gone by the wayside, and nobody really talks about doing that anymore. I haven't heard that in a long time. But it's a very similar theory about holding who you're holding responsible. If you're holding the actual perpetrator responsible, or if you're holding essentially someone else responsible for a third-party action. And I think those are, I think that's a reasonable, from my perspective, I think that's a reasonable analogy to make.
Thanks for that call. Harry Wilson is with us from Roanoke College. He's the author of Gun Politics in America, Historical and Modern Documents in Context, talking about a lawsuit, this one going on in Connecticut state courts, from Sandy Hook parents challenging Remington, the gun manufacturer. That state Supreme Court says the lawsuit can move ahead. That doesn't mean it's a done deal. U.S. Supreme Court may weigh in on that. Let's bring on another caller now. Ken is with us in Kenosha. Ken, hello.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ken?
I wanted to bring up that why not, instead of putting it on the manufacturer, require gun owners or people who possess guns to have liability insurance similar to owning a car. So that way, if your gun is either misused by you or by someone else to cause damage, then, you know, there is a large pool of money from which you could pay things like medical costs, pain and suffering and things like that. And I know that may kind of fly in the face of the Second Amendment, but I don't know that, you know, you have the right to bear arms, but, you know, we can also say, and you must carry liability insurance to do so.
Ken, thanks for the call. Jack that on Facebook suggested something similar. Harry, I hadn't really heard about this. Is this an idea that's been floated out there?
I have heard of this, and I'll be frank with you, I'm not overly familiar with it, but I have heard of it. I suspect, I don't think that would run afoul of the Second Amendment, because that's not unless the requirement was that you had $100 million in insurance, which something like Sandy Hook could easily run into that amount of money, that you had that amount of insurance. Requiring some sort of insurance, I don't think would. I'm not an attorney, but I don't think that would run afoul of the Second Amendment, because that's not prohibiting you from owning the firearm. That would simply say you need to have some sort of coverage here. The question is, I guess I would question whether the people who are bringing this lawsuit are really trying to recover damages, or if they're really trying in some way to. I think my assumption would be, perhaps incorrect, but my assumption would be what they're really trying to do is in some way prohibit the production of AR-style rifles, or in some way prevent Remington from manufacturing these. That's my assumption. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think they're really in this essentially for the money. I think they're in this trying to enact policy change.
Thanks for that call. Harry, to that point, do you think this is an argument maybe better had in state legislatures and Congress rather than the courts?
Well, I think it's in some ways, I think yes, but that would be my fallback position on most things like this. So it's not only in firearms, I would say. But I think that's the case. And I think really, again, that it's very difficult to overcome the obstacles that were put in place by that 2005 Act of Congress, which says state or federal. Clearly. So even states would have a difficult time, I think, getting around this. It would really be an act of Congress. And there have been members of Congress today who are trying to rescind this 2005 Act, by the way. I don't know that that would go very far. And as an interesting piece of political, perhaps minutiae now, but we think of bipartisanship as a long ago time, when this law was passed in 2005, it was largely along party lines. Republicans in the Senate voted for this 50-2, but Democrats only voted against it 29-14. So there were 14 Democratic senators in 2005 that voted in favor of this, and there were 50 Democrats in the House of Representatives that voted in favor of this. If this came up today, you'd probably find one Democratic senator, I would say, that would vote in favor of this. And in the House of Representatives, I don't know, I'd go out on a limb and say maybe five. And you wouldn't find many Republicans voting against it. It's interesting how the politics has changed in that 15-year span or 14-year span now.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Harry Wilson, professor of political science and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in Virginia. He's also the author of several books on the topic of gun control and public opinion. His latest book is called Gun Politics in America, Historical and Modern Documents in Context. He joins us to talk about a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer Remington filed by parents of Sandy Hook Elementary School students. Connecticut Supreme Court says one part of that lawsuit related to marketing of guns can go through. U.S. Supreme Court is being invited to weigh in. We'll see what happens there. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, last week's mass shooting in New Zealand is the latest in a string of white supremacist attacks around the globe. An expert on extremist violence looks at ideology, terror, and the role of social media. And we'll hear about a National Guard program that helps families when a loved one deploys outside of the state or out of the country. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:15, Kate and her guests talk about opioid addiction and recovery and the role of recovery coaches who help people through their efforts to overcome addiction. Find out more tomorrow at 7:15 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the ways that careers are becoming a religion of sorts for many Americans and why they might not be able to deliver the purpose and meaning people are looking for. You can find the article that the conversation's based on the Ideas Network Facebook page and share your thoughts while you're there. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.